for being here. I appreciate your presence. Many of you have been an encouragement to me. Many of you have been very kind to say that I'm not too hard to listen to. We were just talking before services about some of the old sermons, though. I remember the one sermon where I talked about that apple that Eve ate. And they just kind of, you know, told me afterwards that really wasn't an apple. We don't know that that was an apple. I told them probably the worst was when I was down at Coleman and I talked about the horse Paul fall off when the light hit him. I saw that on a film strip, I think. I remembered it. Boy, that was terrible. And I don't believe I'll ever forget the time that Christine Yost said to me after a sermon, "Keep studying, keep studying." And I pray I will, and that I might continue to improve. Some of the songs this evening have been talking about the family and the home and the Christian home. And I count each and every Christian home as a gem, as a jewel, as a treasure, as the foundation really of this society. And I wonder about our society if there are fewer Christian homes percentage-wise, if those Christian homes are eroded, made weaker, I wonder about the strength of our society. And I wonder if you've ever asked an older person what they thought about the society, they generally say that they think it's deteriorating. They think that it is getting weaker morally, that the fabric that they attribute America's greatness to is somehow ebbing, going away, and it's a terrible thing. It's my judgment that a lot of what's wrong with American families is what's wrong with American men. I don't think I'm alone in that evaluation. A few years ago, down in Washington, D.C., was held the Million Man March at the input of the Nation of Islam under the lead of Louis Farrakhan, and he called men, predominantly black men, to come to Washington. And there he spoke to them along with a number of other speakers, and he urged them to go home and to be better parents, to be better husbands, to be better citizens in the community. And they continue to push that message as they have opportunity. A few years ago, there was a beginning of an organization called Promise Keepers. You've probably heard of them. Heavily, they're led by a man who was a coach at, I believe, a college level and also a Christian. And he gets large assemblies of men together in auditoriums, in outside stadiums usually. And they also, I believe, were down in Washington not too long ago. And their message is, men, be men. Stand in the gap. Be stronger. Be Christian. Be like Christ in the home. If you can judge from those things, you'd have to agree that our society feels like men need to be men and decide that there's all sorts of helps that men need to be men. Men need to be men. We need to be men. But there's a biblical way to do it. I don't believe we have to look any farther than the Bible for our guide. I don't believe we have to look any farther than the local church for the agency to help us become and help us to stay strong. Men, it's to you that I'm speaking tonight, that I'm going to hit the hardest. Women, get the elbows ready, but try to keep them in check because that always swings back the other way at you, it seems. The best way, the Lord's way, for women to be taught is for the younger women to ask the older women to help them. I think there's two problems with that scenario. First, that the younger women ask for help seems to be a problem. They don't usually ask too much. And then also, getting one of the older women to admit they're an older woman is usually a problem. But if you can both submit to God's will, that's the way to learn about the woman's role. I'm not going to speak about that. I'm going to speak, level both barrels, as it were, at you men this evening and at me particularly. And men, let's use this coming hour, or no, not an hour, but this coming time to see if we can become better at being the man that Christ would have us to be. But that doesn't mean I'm only talking to men. I'm talking to boys. Boys, This is the goal that's set before you. This is the character into which you should grow and grow into this. Be such a man as we're going to talk about tonight. Young women, this is what you're looking for. Boy, one of the worst. I didn't know when I got into preaching what would be the worst part of it. And really the worst part of it for me has been to see women who've been attached to some very sorry excuses for husbands and having to help them deal with the decision, you know, the problem that was there from an unwise choice. Choose wisely, young women. Find a man like the one we're going to talk about in the coming sermon. And all of us, we can all use this, because the characteristics that make a good man are often characteristics that we all should have. Now, there are all sorts of biblical examples about men and who is a good man. And you can look at them and you can make a composite character out of many and come up with a wonderful example. We talked about David, and we all know David had his shortcomings, but David is a very good example in many respects. Moses is a very strong man and a leader. We can go on and on. Always the best example is Christ. And we should each be trying to grow up into a measure of the stature of the fullness of Him and to be more like Him every day. But I want you to look with me tonight at an Old Testament figure that I find truly astounding. I think is incredible. And we're not going to pull out of the Bible tonight more than is in there, but we're going to milk it for every drop, and we're going to find some instructions from us from the Old Testament, and especially from the book of Ruth. When was the last time you had a lesson from the book of Ruth? The story of Ruth is a very tragic story in many ways. It seems that there was this couple in verse 2, Elimelech and Naomi, and they went to sojourn in the country of Moab. This couple, Elimelech and Naomi, and their sons, Mahlon and Chilion, they went down into this foreign country to live there. While they were there, the two sons married. The wives' names were Orpah and Ruth. It says that later Elimelech died, leaving Naomi a widow. And then it seems like 10 years after that, both of the sons died, leaving three widows together. And in this time, before Social Security, as meager as it sometimes is, and before other programs, this was a most desperate situation. There was very little support as a network for these people, especially since they were removed from their families. They were in a foreign country. Their situation was desperate. Naomi, probably feeling that she had been a burden on these people ever since her husband had died, finally just released them and said, "I can't give you anything more. I don't have anything to give you. I don't have any more sons. And even if I conceived today, how long would it be before those men would be grown and you could marry them? I'm of no use to you. Go back. Just go back to your own families and see if maybe they can take you in." This is a tearful, tearful time. And they were all weeping, it says in verse 14. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, meaning she accepted the advice. She kissed her and said goodbye. She went back, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back." Naomi's saying this. "Orpah's gone back to her people, to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." She says, "Ruth, you go too." Mo, do you have the King James? I've got the New King James, and I always hate to read this in the New King James because it's no good in the New King James. Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. We use those words often as examples of a love between a husband and a wife, and how incredible they are as an expression of a daughter-in-law to a mother-in-law from whom she has no good expectation of a return. There's nothing that Naomi has left for Ruth, yet Ruth has this committed love to her. I'm not leaving. I'm going with you. What else could Naomi do? I guess she gave her good advice. She wouldn't take it. So off they go. They go home and Naomi's recognized. Hey, isn't that Naomi? She says, don't call me Naomi anymore. She says in verse 20, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Remember the bitter waters of Mara. Mara means bitter. Bitterness typified her life as she saw it. In verse 21, I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me? The Almighty has afflicted me. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. And here we read in the next verse about the man I want to present to you as a model, man, to us as a model, the man of Boaz. Very unique character. Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him whose sight I may find favor. In whose sight I might find favor. She said to her, go, my daughter. Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. She got to the field of a man who was a kinsman. Now there's a deep significance to this idea of being a kinsman, and we're going to talk about that later. But at this point, it's enough to know that this man is related, and she gets to the field of the one she intended to go to, that Naomi said she should go to, and she starts to glean. Now, do you remember what gleaning is? After the reaping, after the harvesting, you can't always get everything out of an acre, as it were, and there's always something left. And you left that little bit that was there that couldn't be gathered up by the big methods and the gross methods of harvesting, and people that were in need could come and could get those few things that were missed and could take them for themselves. That was her prospect. That was what she was going to do when she came to this field. Now, what I want you to do is watch Boaz very carefully as we go over the next few chapters and see what we learn about the man and what we can take as an example from his character. It says in verse 4, now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And that might seem like a small thing, but to me that says there is a man whose faith is not hidden. There is a man who is not afraid to greet someone in the name of the Lord. The Lord be with you. There's no doubt, even just from that greeting, that that is a man of faith. And a man who is sharing his faith and encouraging others as well. And they answered him, the Lord be bless you. So he's already setting a godly, a righteous air about him as he's going on here. This isn't the first that we see him. Then Boaz says to his servants who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And it seems to me that if the man were not a diligent workman and a diligent overseer of those things that were done in his realm, he wouldn't have noticed. Here's a new person, and I don't know how many reapers or different things are going on here, but he says, hey, there's a new person here. Who's the new person? It implies diligence to me, and it also implies a caring. Caring we're going to see later, but man, we need to be diligent in the things that we do. We need to give attention to those things that we do, not working just when the bosses are looking, but working as unto the Lord, as the scriptures say. Boaz was like this. Well, in verse 6, the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, it's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house. And it seems there that like they were impressed with her diligence in her gleaning. She's been right at it. She's been gleaning with her heart with diligence. In verse 8, then Boaz said to Ruth, he comes to her. And without being haughty, he's still directly with respect. You will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go in another field, nor go from here, but stay close to my young women. She's just come into his knowledge, into his realm recently. And what's he doing? He's, in a sense, he's taking her under his wing and he is protecting her. Men, we should think about that. When we think about people that come into our sphere, we're there, we're protecting them. Sometimes it seems to me that men see women come into their sphere and they think, what can I get from that woman? Or what can I take from that woman? What thing might I get by hook or by crook from that person? How might I take advantage of for myself? Here Boaz is saying, I'm going to protect you. You stay by with my young women. In verse 9, let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Have I not commanded young men not to touch you? See what I mean about protection? He'd already told his young men, you leave her alone. Protection. When you're thirsty, she was just there gleaning. She didn't have any right to drink from their water, but he gives her that right. When you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. This is an incredible blessing that he is giving to her. She realizes it in verse 10. She fell on her face, bowed down to the ground and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? And there was a race issue here. This was a woman from another race. Another nation. She was a Moabitess. She was not a Jew. And yet, he's giving her all this favor, all this respect, all this protection. It's amazing. In verse 11, Boaz answered and said to her, it has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 8, it talks about one of the criteria for an elder of the Lord's church, is that he is a lover of good. Boaz typifying that. I've heard of the good that you've done. And God bless you for the good that you've done. He's encouraging one who has done well. And that's something we need to do, men. Sometimes with our children, we look for the faults and we give them the rebuke. We think that we're doing well. We need to find the good too. He found the good. He praised her for it. But then notice what he said in verse 12. You've come under the Lord's wing. He saw himself as an agent of the Lord. You've come under my wing, really. But you've come under the Lord's wing because I'm acting on his behalf. I'm going to treat you well because he wants you treated well and I'm his servant. In verse 13, then she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So now even the meals are extended to her. So she sat beside the reapers and he passed parched grain to her and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back for Naomi at home. And when she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men saying, let her glean even among the sheaves. Do not reproach her. You know, the sheaves were where the good stuff was. We talked about gleaning. Gleaning's picking up the leavings. You let her glean among the stuff that you've gathered. It's a way for him to provide even more for her. And also let some grain from the bundles fall purposely. Get sloppy out there when you're harvesting. You know, spill some.
so she'll have something to pick up. So she gleaned in the field until evening, beat out what she had gleaned. It was about an ephah of barley, and as I understand it, that was a good day's gleaning. She took it up and went to the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. So she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied of the stuff that was ready to eat. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where have you gleaned today? Where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz," just like she'd been told. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of the Lord, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." There's a family responsibility with the dead kinsman. He's been true to this responsibility as a man. Naomi said to her, "The man is a relative of ours, one of our near kinsmen." And that's of even more biblical significance than the idea of kinsmen. And we're going to study that more in a minute, but Ruth the Moabitess said in verse 21, "He also said to me, 'You shall stay close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.' And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, 'It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young woman and that people do not meet you in any other field.'" As far as a good day's result, as far as going to glean, she'd had the best day you could have. This had all worked out very well. And they attributed all these blessings to Boaz. He was the one that made this a wonderful day. I want you to think about how destitute she was when she showed up that day. How little she had. But she received much by the grace of God through this man, Boaz. And it says later in verse 23, in effect, that about 2 months passed by with things going on like this. And then in verse 1 of chapter 3, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you?" It's time to do something of a more permanent nature. "Now Boaz, whose young woman were with you, you were with, is he not our kinsman? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash yourself and anoint yourself. Put on your best garment and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known unto the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies. You shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do." And she said to her, "All that you say to me, I will do." Now, to our 20th century ears, this sounds improper. This sounds bad. It just frankly doesn't sound right. But I think we've got to understand what's going on here. If we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 5, Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 5, we can see what the duty was of a near kinsman. It says there, "If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of the dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel." You remember when they came to Jesus, the Sadducees did, and they wanted to trap him in some sort of a fancy question. They talked about a woman marrying a brother, and they're having no children, and the brother dies, so she marries the next brother. That proceeded from this teaching back in Deuteronomy. That was the responsibility. If your brother died without leaving an heir, you married that widow, and the child that was born received part of your inheritance in the name of your brother. It was a very big sacrifice, I guess, that was to be made to keep the name going in Israel. We could also go back to Leviticus 25 and verse 25, and we can see that there's a rule there for redeeming property that had been owned by a kinsperson. You could buy that property, and it would be yours, though it had been someone else's. And when she mentions a near kinsman, Boaz being the near kinsman, she says, this is the one whose duty it is to marry you. Now, this is before the day of marriage licenses, before the day of blood tests, before the day, I guess, that you'd even need any kind of a fancy ceremony. When she sent, Naomi sent Ruth to go and get uncover his feet and get there, that was almost as invoking his responsibility as near kinsman. Take me as your wife, she would be saying by her actions. And it was proper. It was fine. In verse 6, so she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. After Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was cheerful. He went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled. There are a few understatements in the Bible. This is one of them. Ho, what is this I find here? It's like when Adam was received woman, and they read that, you know, oh, this is bone of my bone and flesh. No, that's not how he said it, I'm sure, you know. This is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. He'd been looking at all that livestock. He was glad to see a woman. And here, you know, whoa, what is this? The man is startled. He turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. He said, who are you? So she answered, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a near kinsman. Those are the code words. He knew exactly what she meant when she said, you're a near kinsman. This whole responsibility kicked in at that point. But friends, men, young men, if Ruth was vulnerable to Boaz when she first showed up to glean, she was 100 times more vulnerable at this moment. In the darkness of the threshing floor, no one to see what would happen with these two people alone. And I put to you that this is the test of a man. This is when we find what a man is made of. And what does he do? In verse 10, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. He esteemed what she did. He respected her for what she did. In verse 11, now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request. And that was a request that she made. For all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. There was nothing dirty about this. This is a virtuous act here. Now, it is true, he says in verse 12, that I am your near kinsman. However, there is a kinsman nearer than I. We didn't know this before. And it doesn't seem like Naomi knew this at all. Boaz knew it. And even in the darkness of the threshing floor, even with no one else to hold him accountable, he goes by the book and says, no, we're not going any further right now. In verse 13, stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a near kinsman for you, good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. So she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. Then he said, do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And it seems like there he's protecting her good name. He's protecting her virtue as he says that. And he said to her, bring the shawl that is on you and hold it. And you know how you can do with a shawl, how you can make it a kind of a basket, even, you know, as you can do with an apron. And when she had held it, he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her as she went into the city. Probably more like a sack on the back. You know, he gave her a whole bunch of grain. In verse 16, so when he came to her mother-in-law, she said, is that you, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, these 6 ephahs of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And she said, sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out. For the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. His reputation, Naomi knew. He said he's going to do this thing, and he's going to do it. He's going to do it today.
a man of action, a man of his word, known by all. All right, now we go in verse 1 of chapter 4. Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the near kinsman of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Come aside, friend, sit down here." So he came aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. He had assembled the people that needed to be present to do this official transaction, this official business that needed to be done. He says to the near kinsman, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people." This was the formal court in which it should be done. "If you redeem it, if you want to buy this land," you've got an option on this land is what it means, because it was Naomi's husband. "If you want it, you buy it. But if you do not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I'm next after you." You're first in line to the land. You can buy it and it'll be yours, and I'm next. And he said, "I will redeem it." Well, the land was a smaller issue. There's another rider on here. There's another issue. Boaz said, "On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead on her, on his inheritance." You take the land, you take the girl. You take the land, you provide the inheritance to the heir that you raise up by the girl. Suddenly the deal had turned sour for the other guy. He says, the near kinsman said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my whole inheritance." I'm going to be financially ruined, he says, if I go ahead and take, if I buy the land and give the inheritance. I can't do that. I'm not in a financial position to do it. But I think it's more than financial, I would think, because there was an honor question here, too. It seems like maybe he's using a financial excuse, but that's just my supposition. Now, in verse 7, "Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was an attestation in Israel. Therefore, the near kinsman said to Boaz, 'Buy it for yourself.' So he took off his sandal. Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, 'You are witnesses that this day I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to raise up the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from the gates of this place. You are witnesses this day.'" Did you think about that? Why did they give a shoe? Do you know that? This is before deed searches and title searches and all of that, and all the things that go on when property is exchanged. You know what? Look at this. If I gave you this to close the deal, you'd know exactly who was in the deal with you, wouldn't you? You could look in here and you could say, "Is that your shoe?" And I could put it on and say, "That's my shoe." And they say, "See, that's his shoe. Now, how would I get that unless this were a real deal?" It was a way to close the deal. They closed the deal. That was the stamp. That was official. Now, they did it before the elders, too. And it says in verse 11, "We are witnesses. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel. And may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman." At the blessing of the elders, the deal is truly closed. And off he goes. So Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. And when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a near kinsman. And may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than 7 sons, has borne him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. Also the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi," and they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. This is a very famous person, a very important person in the lineage of David, in the lineage of our Lord that came through this interesting character. Man, this is just one of the incredible characters in the Bible that call us to be better men. This man, Boaz, was incredible. He was an openly religious, openly devout man. He respected others. He was a diligent worker. When a vulnerable person came into his charge, he saw himself as an arm of the Lord to protect and to give alms, to give care for a less fortunate one. And even in the darkness of the threshing floor, where no one else was there to hold him accountable and no one else was there to supervise, he went by the book and did the right thing. He was able to go in front of the elders, or in front of the people of the community, and conduct his business, to do it right. He was a man that Naomi knew would get things done. Friends, if you take men, if you take Boaz as an example and try to live up into his shoes, you'll be doing well. And if the Lord blesses that, you'll be elder material when the time comes. If the Lord blesses, lots can happen, but it's just an incredible thing. Now, I challenge us men to do this. This isn't the kind of lesson, I don't think, that leads people running to the front of the building. But if you've got to come forward and confess some things that your children know you've been doing, or that others know that you've been doing that a man shouldn't do, this is going to be the time to do it. But men, there's probably some things that your bride needs to have cleared up. You know, that you might just, when you get home tonight, need to take her aside and say, I haven't been doing what I should. I haven't been living as I should, and if God gives me time, I'm going to try harder, and I'm going to do better. Will you forgive me? And wife, that's your cue, not to say I told you so, but to say, yes, dear, let's go on from here. Friends, this is a wonderful life that the Lord's blessed us with. Let's continue to try to be what he wants us to be, to walk worthy of the calling of which we've been called, to grow up in a measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Who here needs to confess something or be baptized into Christ? All things are ready for that to be done right now. If you're subject to the call, come while we stand and while we sing.